Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The industrialization of American agriculture made the U.S. into the breadbasket of the world. But the same juggernaut is packing animals into ever tighter factory farms and stripping nutrients from the soil. The organic counter movement has been growing on plots across the U.S. So far, it's mostly boutique and high priced. But there is a vision of another way, maybe something better, something even more sustainable. Tonight on Point, beyond industrial farming, beyond organic farming, with small farm pioneer and grassland libertarian Joel Salatin. But first, we begin tonight in Texas with a big twist in the prisoner abuse case against Army reservist Lindy England. Today, a military judge threw out the guilty plea from the 22-year-old Iraq War veteran from Maryland for her role in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. England was photographed holding a naked prisoner on a leash at the prison. The judge, Colonel James Pohl, said he was not convinced she knew her actions were illegal at the time. For perspective on this development, we turn to Gail Gibson, national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. She joins me now from Killeen, Texas, outside the Army's Fort Hood. Gail, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Gail, it's hard to understand how Army justice works, how a guilty plea can be thrown out. If Lindy England says, hey, here I am, I'm guilty, why is the judge pushing back?
Well, in any court, civilian or military, someone who pleads guilty has to really be guilty. But the military system actually has a very extensive process where the defendant is questioned at length about whether they, how well they understand that their actions were wrong at the time they were doing them. And Lindy England, Private England, seemed a little unsure of this earlier in the week. The judge accepted her plea, went ahead with the proceedings. But that was again thrown in doubt today by testimony from one of her fellow soldiers, actually her former boyfriend, Charles Grainer.
Now, Charles Grainer is already in prison. This is the man who was her commanding officer at Abu Ghraib, also the father of her child, though they have no relationship now. He's married to another one of the defendants in this case, as I read. What did he say that turned the judge against the guilty plea?
Well, Grainer, who he actually was not Private England's commander at the prison. They were he was higher ranking than her, but didn't have her in the chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
But what he said today is, as Grainer has insisted throughout this past year, that the abuses that were photographed at the prison were part of a legitimate guard control of prisoners at the Abu Ghraib facility. The problem with that is it threw into doubt whether England thought what she was doing was wrong, as would have to be the case for her to plead guilty, or whether she thought, because Grainer had told her, that they were doing something they needed to do to keep control of unruly Iraqi detainees.
Now, Lindy England told the judge earlier this week that she believed the pictures were being taken purely for the amusement of the guards. This doesn't sound like an order from anyone or part of a greater plan. The judge simply believed Grainer over England?
Well, the problem is that he didn't give one person's weight more than another, he being the judge. But the problem is that what Grainer said, and because he was put on the stand by her own defense attorneys, it essentially created a defense for England after she had already said, I plead guilty, I acknowledge there's no defense for my actions. And in the military system, that is grounds for a judge to throw out your guilty plea. By obligation, he had to enter a not guilty plea on England's behalf. And for her, that sends the case back to square one.
Gil, help us look through the surface of this at the tensions behind. On the one hand, she was pleading guilty. On the other hand, she wanted the most lenient sentence. So she had reason to kind of downplay how bad she had been. But are there other tensions here as well? Was she encouraged to plead guilty in order to, I don't know, make this trial shorter, make the exposure of all these this abuse again less gruesome, less public? What's the backstory? Is there one?
Well, I think there was a real incentive here for Lindy England to try and get this plea deal through. She's a young woman. She's 22 years old. She's also a new mother. She and Charles Grainer had a child together who's now 7 months old, and she is raising that baby boy as a single mother. This is a person who didn't want to go to jail for a long time, and she was, you know, she looked ready this week to try and put this thing behind her. And unfortunately, Grainer himself prevented that from happening today.
But either way, she'd be looking at some years in jail, most likely, or not?
Well, it is a little tricky, the military system. She reached a deal with prosecutors. It was not disclosed publicly, but it was thought to be probably no more than a couple years' time. But she also would have gotten the benefit of a lesser sentence if that had been recommended by a jury, a military jury that was considering her case as well. And they could have given her no jail time. Whether they would have done that, we don't know, because when the judge declared a mistrial today, he sent that jury home.
Now, Grainer pled innocent himself. What do his interests look like here? Would he have an interest in throwing a roadblock across her guilty plea intentionally?
Well, Grainer took an unusual step yesterday. He is in custody, obviously, but he slipped a written note out to reporters who are covering this case here saying he wished Lindy well, even though he wished she had fought the charges. And, you know, by all appearances, his statements this morning weren't aimed at foiling her case. He's just saying what he has said all along, that he believes these were legitimate techniques that they were employing. And that's what he thought he was doing there. Of course, the practical effect is it actually hurt her plea deal quite a bit.
And finally, Gail, are there other cases that will come up related to Abu Ghraib? Are there others still in the wings to be charged and tried?
Well, there is one, the last of the seven original defendants from the Abu Ghraib cases, a lesser defendant named Sabrina Harmon, is scheduled to go to trial next week, again here at Fort Hood. We don't know if today's events will derail that at all. Lindy England had been a possible witness for that case. But now, of course, we've got Lindy England back on the docket at some point in the future.
And higher-ups, are they finished with this case?
Well, there were no higher-ups charged directly in the Abu Ghraib abuses. And, in fact, the Pentagon, about a week ago, finally said that all of the higher-ranking commanders had been cleared.
Gail Gibson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Gail Gibson is national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. She spoke with me from Killeen, Texas. The marriage of technology and economies of scale has turned American farming into a giant industrial agricultural system. The conversion, now nearly complete, has changed more than just the way we grow food. It's changed what we eat, the way we live, our relationship with the land and food we live on. Now, industrial agriculture is a favorite target. Critics argue that factory-raised animals are mistreated and unappetizing, that pesticides and petro-fertilizers make soil barren, that if we are what we eat, we should do better. One of those critics is with me tonight with his critique and a new way. The New York Times calls him the high priest of the pasture because his ideas are catching on. This hour on Point, we're going back to the land, beyond industrial farming, beyond organic farming, to sustainable permaculture with agro-pioneer, farm philosopher, and muddy boots libertarian Joel Salatin. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you know where your food comes from? In an age of industrial agriculture, is there a scalable place for small farms, for sustainable farming, for food that just might taste better? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Polyface Farm in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley is Joel Salatin, innovator, author, and beyond organic farmer. Mr. Salatin, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you with us.
I'm a son of the soil. Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Salatin.
Sons of the soil all here tonight. Joel Salatin, what is it that you're up to down there that's got people's heads turning quite so hard?
Well, I guess the easy way to say it would be that we're actually making a good living on a small farm, but we're not sacrificing the ecology or the environment or social issues in order to do it. And that's a pretty exciting combination.
How rare, how unusual is that today?
Well, it's I think it's very rare. Most farmers are, you know, using either independent equity, bringing it to their farm, or, you know, working off the farm and doing the farm as a part-time project. Or they're joining the industrial or even the organic empire and getting very, very large and not really being, you know, independent entrepreneurs.
We understand the characterization of industrial agriculture as an empire, but you call organic an empire, too, and with no small disillusionment in your voice at this point. Why?
Well, an empire by any other name is still an empire, whether you call it organic, biological, sustainable, or whatever you want to call it. And as you, I'm sure, are aware, in the organic movement, which is what we called it back 30 years ago, the organic movement is undergoing the same type of centralization, consolidation, acquisition, and slick advertising and doublespeak as, you know, as the system that it that the movement began. In fact, the organic industry even calls itself an industry now rather than a movement. And so, you know, there's a tremendous compromise in the organic movement as a result of government involvement and the centralization and all the Wall Streetification of the movement.
But some people might celebrate that, saying organic's caught on, it's going mainstream. You're critical of it. Why?
Well, the enemy of best is good, and I think that what we're after here is not just another system, you know, organic Twinkies. What we're after is not eating Twinkies. For example, you know, 10,000 birds, 10,000 layers in a confinement house still does not allow the chicken to really express its chickenness.
So if 10,000 chickens are crammed together, even if they're eating organic, they're not having much of a good time.
Absolutely. And, of course, you know, beef, organic beef, is still grain-fed in a feedlot that stinks to high heavens, and the cattle are being fed unnatural feeds. So, you know, organic is a very non-comprehensive term and doesn't account for many of the variables that exist.
Joel Salatin, stand by. There's a lot more we want to learn about you and what you're up to down there. We're talking tonight with sustainable farming pioneer and grassland libertarian Joel Salatin. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking beyond industrial farming tonight, beyond organic farming, to permaculture farming with sustainable farming pioneer and grassland libertarian Joel Salatin. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you know where your food comes from? Do you know what a factory business farming has become? Is there a scalable place in the era of industrial agriculture for small farms, sustainable farming? And could we go back to the future in American agriculture, innovate on the old, and move away from chemicals and giant feedlots? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joel Salatin, there's a lot more we want to learn about exactly what you're up to and what's driving you. But, Jack, I just want to get your top-level thoughts on the food we eat, the way it's produced today, and Joel Salatin out there in his muddy boots trying to do it a different way.
Well, you know, when we go to the supermarket and buy almost any processed food and many fresh fruits, we're buying, well, among other things, politics. We're buying a system of we're also buying socialism. Today in Montana, there would be no net income from farming without subsidies. Think of that. And we're buying rural poverty, because the economies of scale that go into the great empires of Archer Daniels Midland and the others are achieved through vast, almost sharecropper arrangements with farmers. And we're buying depopulation of the Great Plains, which is in many places a kind of ghost town or assemblage of ghost towns. The irony, of course, is that the farmer was supposed to stand for independence. Jefferson thought the small landowners, he called them the most precious part of a state. And early on, the country thought that they were a special national interest, and then they needed special public protection. But this has grown into the system we have today, whereby through politicians and subsidies, essentially many farmers farm the government. Victor David Hansen, a radical farmer, has said you can make money in agriculture if you don't grow food, meaning if you make stuff, corn, soybeans, for the processors. Mm. this is the system that we're buying at the supermarket. And Mr. Salahan is saying, wait a minute, you're buying into something that's real bad all the way down. It goes right back to Bob Dole with his 50 bills for ethanol, for subsidies for Archer Daniels Midland. It goes back to the apartment that he got from Duane Andreas of Archer Daniels Midland, that less than market cost. It goes back to McNeil Lira, which is brought to you by Archer Daniels Midland.
Oh,
it's bad.
Joel Salatin, there's a few bales of hay for you to feast on. I don't know where to begin. How does that line up with your critique of mainstream farming?
There's a man talking my language. and what I find fascinating is that all the things that Jack just mentioned, the Montana no net income, the rural poverty, depopulation of the Great Plains,
yes,
farming the ground, all those elements are never addressed in organic standards or the government's organic certification
program.
You mean
because they just live off in the margins of that and don't go at it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so what has happened is that the duplicitous American consumer thinks they're buying into a totally integrated, holistic, interconnected system of soul. And what's happened is that as organic pioneers have sold their fledgling entrepreneurial businesses to the multinational and the conglomerates, they have taken the soul out of organics and are driving the price down and creating the same commoditization and the same corporatization, Wall Streetification scheme in organics as anything else. And what we're doing here is totally local, entrepreneurial based, and integrated, diversified, decentralized, autonomous, rural-driven. I mean, all the things, the government's not involved.
Boy, I want to get it right down to the farmyard level, because you guys are getting very highfalutin on me with the soul of organic farming. We won't ignore it, but I want to understand sort of from the ground up, Joel Salatin, what you're talking about. How are you farming? What are you doing that's so different from mainstream industrial agriculture and from the organic farming you're critical of?
Sure. The first question we ask is, how can we provide a habitat for every plant and animal that allows it to fully express its physiological distinctiveness, i.e., the cowness of the cow, the chickenness of the chicken, the tomatoness of the tomato? This is such a foundational question to respect and honor life and the design that's there. And that is a radically different question. That question is never asked in most of agriculture today. All we ask is, how can we grow more of it and how can we make it cheaper? And so our fundamental question on our farm is, how can we most closely duplicate nature's template of design in this animal or plant so that it fully expresses its physiological distinctiveness?
Get very practical with us. How do you do that with you name it, with your
right,
cows,
with
your
with
hogs,
cow,
your chickens?
All right? Let's take a cow.
Mm-hmm.
What is a cow? A cow is an herbivore. Herbivores in nature do not eat grain. They do not eat fermented forage. They are mobbed up in groups when they graze due to predators lurking in the sidelines, and they're constantly moving to fresh areas.
Okay.
Those are four principles of nature's pattern: movement, mobbing, and diet. And when we our cows never eat grain, they never eat silage, and they're mobbed up with techno-glitzy electric fencing through our management to duplicate the social effect that herd would have, and they're moved every day to a fresh salad bar to mimic the herd undulating movement that the American bison or the wildebeest on the Serengeti show to us anytime we see a nature documentary.
A fresh salad bar, you're not talking at Denny's.
No, I'm talking about a diversified polyculture. Let's talk about what those herbivores are eating. In nature, you never see fields of alfalfa, fields of corn, fields of monoculture. In nature, a prairie, a pasture situation will have 40 different species of plants per acre. It's called a polyculture of plants, a perennial prairie polyculture. And when that happens, we get the greatest growth and solar collection and biomass production in that acre, because some roots go deep, some go shallow, some plants like shade, some like sun. And so you get this wonderful strata, this vertical growth in the pasture, as opposed to trying to maintain a very unnatural monoculture system through tillage or through chemical application.
You know, Joe Salatin, I was a small farm, born and raised. Did a lot of farming as a youngster in the 60s. What you're describing sounds an awful lot like what was done then with our cattle, but a lot less like what was done soon after, when everybody went to silos and tighter containment. What drove American farmers, even relatively small farmers, in those next decades, to tighten everything up, go more to compact and chemical?
Well, I think a lot of it was cheap energy and cheap transportation, the ability to move products mechanically, you know, with augers and big truck bins, and of course the Transcontinental Railroad opened up the grain belt. So the cheap energy and the transportable ability to move grains, and of course you have the farm programs, which pushed people to grow to the farm program instead of grow to what nature wanted. And the point that I'm trying to make is that nobody was sitting down. You know, it's our philosophical underpinnings that actually drive or put moral boundaries around our human cleverness. And we're clever enough as humans to invent things and create things that we cannot morally or ethically metabolize. And so, you know, we have learned how to harvest and plant and fertilize corn using global positioning satellite technology, but nobody has asked, do we need to grow this much corn?
And on the other hand, everybody's trying to make a living. Can you make a living pushing your cows from salad bar to salad bar? And I guess by that you mean from rich section of pasture to the next rich section of pasture.
Yes, absolutely. We, in Augusta County here, the cow days average per acre is 70. A cow day is what one cow will eat in one day. And on our farm, where we have not planted a seed, we own no plow, no tiller, and we haven't bought an ounce of chemical fertilizer in more than 40 years, we haven't planted a seed in more than 40 years, we're averaging 400 cow days per acre. That's, what, five times the county average. And what happens is when we mimic nature instead of trying to override nature with human cleverness and arrogance, nature will pay us back tenfold more than we can ever imagine if we try to override natural patterns with human cleverness.
You say that agriculture was the last occupation to enter the industrial age, that it will be the last to leave it. You're clearly trying to push it out. Do you have a vision? Can you imagine someplace on the other side of industrial agriculture, an America that once again has thousands and thousands of smallish farms like yours? What, you've got 550 acres there, of small farms providing produce, livestock, like you do, to the immediate vicinity. Is that a realistic future?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There are. it certainly is. And just if you want to look at it from a grand scale, just imagine 70% of the grain grown in the United States goes through herbivores. Goes through multi-stomached animals. Only 30% goes through pigs, people, and poultry. Imagine what it would do to our ecology, our chemical use, our agriculture petroleum use, our erosion, all of those things, if we converted the 70% of the row crop acreage back to perennial prairie polycultures under intensive herbivore management. We could grow twice as much meat and milk per acre nationally as we do now, running on solar energy as opposed to petroleum.
Wow, we're talking radical, but it's exciting. Listeners, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with sustainable farming pioneer Joel Salatin. Cecil's calling from Chena, Washington. Hi, Cecil. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
A few years ago, I found a book at the library called Pastured Poultry Profits.
Yes.
And that's Joel's book,
right?
Or at least one of his books. And since I was really, really sick of eating factory chicken, I decided to try and go ahead and experiment it. I just bought 40 acres here in Cheney.
Yeah.
And used his model for the last 5 years. And I recently, unlike him, I had really bad land to begin with. So I had to plant some. But this year will be my first year where I'm actually raising chickens according to his model, and just starting to really integrate his system to be profitable.
And how's it work? Can you make money? Do they taste good? Do they sell?
They're amazing. amazingly good. I have people call me by word of mouth only. I can sell probably 2,000 or 3,000 this year, and in Joel's system, he never raises anything that he doesn't already have pre-sold. And I haven't gotten that far because I haven't needed to, because people keep coming to me and asking me if I will raise more.
And when you hear, Cecil, you're following the Salatin formula. When you hear Joel Salatin talk about the cowness of the cow or the chickenness of the chicken, do you roll your eyes or do you know what he's talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, the earth is a system. And if we humans have done a lousy job of messing up that system by thinking we are so smart.
Well, we've got it. Cecil, thank you so much for your call. Joel Salatin, there's an acolyte in Cheney, Washington, who's raising chickens your way.
Yes, sir. There are thousands and thousands of people around this land that have seen this model and know that it works and are raising for their own communities, their own neighborhoods, and we can literally put, I would even suggest, millions of farmers back on the land and raising food for their bioregion, and stop this nonsense of centralized production, centralized processing, and 1,500 miles under every morsel of food on the America's plate. The average T-bone steak in America sees more of the country than the farmer that grew it.
But you're up against a mighty big industry on the other side. I want to bring another voice into this conversation from Austin, Texas. Fred Walters is joining us. He's editor of Acres USA, the country's oldest monthly magazine on sustainable agriculture. Fred, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
So Joel's got this vision of this new kind of agriculture spreading right across the world. I bet you share it. Is it actually happening, or is this pie in the sky?
Well, it's not pie in the sky. There are a lot of Joel Salatins scattered around the world. What's amazing is Joel's interest in experimenting and learning, but also his willingness to share. He opens his farm up every day. He's got groups coming through. This summer is a huge field day planned, and people come from all over the world to study his methods, his models. And so he's devised systems that show that you can make a living growing really good food.
And can you see this one day producing a significant portion of America's crops?
Well, we really have to do something. The countryside, Jack had mentioned that the countryside is more or less been emptied. The average age of farmers in the U.S. is now 65, ranchers 67. It needs to be resettled almost.
Well, does it? I mean, the industrial agriculture might say, well, that's all right. We'll just sweep in a couple of times a year with the big equipment, plant the stuff, put the chemicals on, take it out. We don't need a lot of people out there.
But consumers won't allow this. Anything, all of the forward progress in getting good food to people is coming. It's not coming out of the USDA, which is totally co-opted now by agribusiness. It's consumer-driven. And people are learning that all eggs are not equal, that milk is not milk, and that fresh, local, non-factory farm food really makes a difference. And they're taking, when it seems like everybody you know either has cancer or has someone they love who suffered it, people are taking their health into their own hands, and they're discovering that food is medicine. And the kind of food that Joel Salatin is growing, it's the best medicine.
Joel, I can tell that you and Fred are singing in the same choir here. Clearly, but what about the scheme of regulation that you're working within, federal oversight? You call yourself you've got a great phrase here, Christian, libertarian, environmental, capitalist. I think we could throw some more in there. You kick down the barn door pretty often when it comes to the government. Can you really see this spreading in the current regulatory system?
Well, I can see it, but it is extremely hampered, and I will tell you that the overriding industrial paradigm is not going to go down without a fight. I mean, for example, in Virginia, when we had this avian influenza outbreak 2 years ago, our farm was called a bioterrorist because our free-range chickens actually commiserate with red-winged blackbirds in the field, who then take our alleged diseases to the clean, sterile Tyson
bacon bin, chicken house.
Chicken, inhumane concentration camp, fecal.
We got the picture.
Camp farms, and infect those birds. And so the point I'm making is that I view myself very much today as Sitting Bull, at the when Custer came down on him. I mean, it it was never good enough for the Westerners, the conquistador mentality, to learn from the Native Americans what they could learn, and let them and have two, you know, an Eastern and a Western culture living in peace. No, one had to destroy the other, and I think that that's much of the system that we're living under today. Is this mentality that unless we put every T-bone steak through a $1.5 million facility, you know, we can't have safe food. And I think that's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, Fred Walters, I know that Joel writes for you once in a while. That's some pretty high-blown language. Are people following?
There are, and it's you're seeing, like there was a case recently made it to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and, you know, the judge there threw it out and said it was a case involving a farmer trying to sell, you know, raw or rather unpasteurized, unhomogenized milk.
And some of those walls coming down. Fred, I know we've got to let you go before the break here, but we're grateful to you for joining us. Fred Walters at Acres USA. We're talking with Joel Salatin, libertarian farmer, tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We are looking beyond industrial farming, beyond organic farming even tonight, to permaculture farming with sustainable farming pioneer and grassland libertarian Joel Salatin. He joins us from his farm, Polyface Farm in Swoop, Virginia. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you inspired by Joel Salatin's story? Are there enough Americans willing to do the work of small farming anymore to make this vision possible? Does this sound like a pipe dream or a real alternative to the current system? If we are what we eat, would Joel Salatin's way make us a better country? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian's calling from Cary, North Carolina. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad you got to my call. I have to say that what Joel is saying sounds scrumptious and very optimistic. And I have to say that I love eating organic food or food that I fancy is organic, and yeah. I like the idea of doing it.
Yeah.
But I'm concerned, and I'd like him to refute my concern, that it's simply a matter of numbers. In an age where we have less and less room in this country, more and more appetites, more bellies to feed as the population increases and as the cost of producing artisanal quality foods goes up, it seems to me that the best organic foods can hope for is kind of like the Macintosh computer. It's a niche market for those who really want to seek what they think is the best, but can it really serve the masses?
Brian, we'll put it right to Joel, but did you hear what I heard? I think I heard Joel say that he would plow under something like 70% of all those grain acres now, turn that into pasture, and raise cattle there. That would sure make a lot more land available.
It absolutely would, but I'm hearing things like twice as much food with solar energy. But looking in the long run, as the cities expand and as the plains diminish, I just wonder as the principle of your show is, that that's really sustainable to feed an explosively growing population.
Let us pick it straight up, and Brian, stick with us. Joel Salatin, there's a somebody who you're making hungry, but he's a doubter.
Yes, well, I can certainly appreciate his doubts because virtually all of the experiments that have been done in food production are not based on symbiotic, synergistic, diversified, stackable enterprises that are complementary.
That's a mouthful. What stackable enterprises?
It is a mouthful. Let me take those one at a time. For example, on our farm, we run an egg mobile behind the cows for the chickens to sanitize behind the pasture from the cows.
In other words, they come and peck through what the cows leave behind.
And so the chickens harvest the grasshoppers, crickets, and fly larvae, mm-hmm. eating off the land. And so we have the cow production per acre, the chicken production, which essentially scavenges behind the cows and eats what the cows won't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And then we run broilers, which are meat chickens, in portable prairie schooner shelters across, and they eat a lot of their diet off the pasture as well as GMO grain that we buy from neighbors.
So the egg-laying chickens first and the broilers, okay, behind
right.
the cattle.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so what happens is that as you get this stacking enterprise, these complementary enterprises, the result of the broilers, we'll say that they go first, the result of the broilers is more grass production for the cows, and the result of the more grass production for the cows is additional insect and material for the laying hens The point being that that acre, instead of just being a dairy pasture or just being a beef pasture or just being a soybean pasture, becomes a multi-speciated, diversified, multiple enterprise production unit, which ratchets up the resource. It ratchets
right, it's kind of multiplier effect there.
It's a multiplier of the resource into usable products.
Now, and we see the numbers off your farm: 30,000 dozen eggs, 10,000-12,000 broilers, 100 head of cattle, 250 hogs, 800 turkeys, 600 rabbits this in a year. But when you do the math right across the country, and here's where Brian's skepticism comes in, we've got almost 300 million Americans now, not to mention exports. Does it add up? Could you convert and feed everybody at a cost that Americans would accept?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that we can produce way more this way than we can with a linear reductionist factory type production model that requires tremendous amounts of inputs to ape nature's pattern, which is naturally diversified, symbiotic, synergistic niches from complementary species in close proximity. I'll give you one more example.
Yeah.
In the winter, we bring our rabbits into tall tunnels, kind of greenhouse, hoop house type things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The rabbits are up at eye level. Underneath them are chickens, and the chickens then scratch through the rabbit droppings, take the earthworms that the rabbit droppings and urine in the bedding create, eat the fresh meat earthworms and sprouted grains in the aerated composting bedding that the chickens are doing. And then
are they happy under those rabbits?
Excuse me?
Are they happy under those rabbits?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
They're happy as can be, absolutely.
And then take your word for that.
Yeah, in the spring, when the chickens and rabbits come back out onto pasture, we go in there with vegetables like, you know, sweet corn or tomatoes or cantaloupes or whatever into that debugged, composted bedding.
Mm-hmm.
And the point being that this facility, instead of being a one species 365 days a year, 24/7 production model with diseases and white flies and bugs like the average White House under one species, it actually doesn't have pathogenic problems because each of the different species is a dead end to the pathogen of the previous one.
Brian, in North Carolina, let me ask you, Joel's got the patter, but he's also got some proof of the pudding here. Are you persuaded?
Well, his optimism is infectious, but as he was giving that example, I was thinking of another example where organic shade-grown coffee, which I love and I think it tastes better, requires huge tracts of forest for the natural shade-loving coffee plant to grow. So I'm wondering if that model that Joel is talking about applies to all sectors of the food industry and not just certain farmable areas, all commodities that Americans are looking for.
Joel?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I'll be the first to say I don't have all the answers. I will tell you, I don't drink coffee myself. In fact, I'm not sure that you ought to be having that much coffee in a non-coffee growing area. I mean, I make a big point of seasonality, bioregionalism, and just because we can grow tomatoes in Mexico and ship them to Maine in January, should we? No, Mainers should be eating all of the tomatoes that backyard gardeners throw away 2 weeks before frost and canning them, making fruit leather and juice and pasta and whatever.
Well, now, wait a minute. Are you telling us we're not going to have our morning coffee? We're going to eat whatever cabbage is left over? I mean, is it a reduced diet that you're seeing the country on under your system? A narrowed diet, I should say, perhaps?
Well, I'm not a coffee aficionado, and I don't want to overstep. I just have to say I'm not sure about specifically coffee. But I can say, as a general rule, what is wrong with adjusting your diet to be in tune with your bioregion?
Well,
what is wrong with that?
Maybe nothing, but it's sure not what we're accustomed to when the strawberries are flown in from Chile.
But we're also accustomed to, to $1.50 gasoline, too.
Well, or we were, going toward double. Brian, thank you for your call. Rhodes is calling from Winchester, Kentucky. Rhodes, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a longtime admirer of Joel's. I'm aware of a group called the Food Lab that's made up of NGOs, representatives from the EU and Brazil, and some larger food companies, among them Sysco and the French grocery company Carrefour, who are trying to imagine a large systems approach to sustainability. And I'd like to ask Joel if he thinks this group has something to add to the efforts at sustainability.
Joel, are you plugged into that movement?
Well, I'm not plugged into that movement, I guess primarily because I'm very skeptical over anything that is large. I think that nature tends toward balance. And if bigness were the answer for things, we'd all be aspiring to be the fattest person on the block. My point is that every paradigm and every ism, every goal has natural limits to it. And I'm not a scarcity proponent, believe me. I'm very much a believer in plenty. But at the same time, a mouse is the size that a mouse is because it's an effective mouse, and an elephant is the size an elephant is because it's an effective element. And when we confuse the two and don't appreciate the ramifications of scalability, we don't appreciate some of the balances that nature naturally throws into any paradigm.
Rhodes, thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, I've got to use you here as a sounding board for the listening nation tonight, thinking about this. It's very infectious enthusiasm Joel has, and it sounds like some very good eating as well. Do you see a country that's dissatisfied enough with the downside of industrial agriculture that it might be willing to, on a large scale, turn towards something different, maybe a little bit narrower range, but better tasting, maybe better for the planet? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I noticed that Joel is just across the mountains there from Charlottesville, and that doesn't surprise me. I mean, I think that this kind of agriculture, really, I don't want to put it this way, but I think the customers tend to be elite customers, either with money or with outlook from education. And that, I think, is very troubling. And I do see in low-wage America that people trooping into getting the lowest price for anything and the convenience and not having to go anywhere. And then on the other hand, the hyper-informed consumer who reads Joel, who understands this theory, who likes taste of things, but a tiny minority. And I really see that even the physical, the diet of Americans just diverging here. And that troubles me. I mean, here in Vermont, you know, it's a rural state. That we have a farmer's market right across the way. There are always cars in the parking lot. But then you look at the cars in that parking lot and the cars in the parking lot in front of the big super Walmart. They're different kind of cars.
Well, Joel Salton, we've just got a minute left. Is your system going to be competitive with the folks who do or need to shop at Walmart for them?
Two answers. Number one is if we could get this, if we could emancipate food from the enslavement of government overregulation and capricious, malicious requirements, absolutely it would change the price of local food dramatically. That's number one. Number two is that I think that a cheap food policy is not a healthy goal to put the best stewards, the best and the brightest of our culture, as the stewards of our watersheds and our landscapes. And there's more nutrition in one egg than in a can of soda, but nobody complains about paying 75 cents for a can of soda. They complain about paying 12 cents for an egg. And we just have to get our priorities straightened out so that we don't bow at the altar of a cheap food disrespected farmer.
Joel Salton, if you were in boxing, Don King would have to watch out. You're in agriculture, and I could see almost anything happening. Good luck with your polyface farm, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. It's been my pleasure.
Listeners, you continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Jack, thanks to you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
In a moment, one small dairy farmer struggles with urban sprawl. This is On Point. Family farms have seen a sharp decline in this country. Their retreat is due in part to competition from large mechanized operations, in part because other opportunities are there for younger generations, and in part because of the encroachment of suburban sprawl. Franklin Moore is one dairy farmer who's tried to keep his family's operation going on Maryland's eastern shore, about an hour and a half outside of Washington, D.C. The son and grandson of farmers, Moore now works his land and feeds his cows with teenage granddaughters at his side. In this radio diary, Franklin Moore says as much as he tries to keep his family operation running, the scene around him is changing.
Our day starts 4 o'clock in the morning. And I've been doing it 50 years this November. And my father did it, started here on the same farm when he got married. Because our grandfather did it the next farm over. So we're still in the same land, going on 100 years. Working out here in the morning hours, it's cold sometimes, but the fresh air, it kind of opens your lungs up and gives you that energy to put in another day. 20 years ago, I could go out in this field and work the tractor back and forth across the field and knew every person within that route because it didn't have tinted glass windows on the cars. And I recognized everybody, and I could wave to everybody, good morning or good afternoon, you know. And now they're going by there so fast with tinted glass, you don't know who they are or where they come from, but they're not local people, what we call local. I mean, they live here, but they commute back and forth to the city to work. On the other side of that woods right there in front of our farm, there's probably a 400-acre farm that they're building houses on right now. And I mean houses are running anywhere from $350,000 to $1 million to build homes that this far from their work. Driving that far every day over here for quiet living. But they brought their noise with them. I mean, they just hustle bustle, buzzing in and out here. And we go out here on the road on it with a tractor and a piece of equipment to go to another farm. We have to be mighty careful. Because they're coming down that road running 60 miles an hour and don't care who's in front of them, just buzzing. And they don't talk anymore about 2 or 3 houses. They're talking about building 100 here and 100 there. And I mean, good farming ground, putting 300 houses on it. I just turned 71 years old, and it's time for with the say the old man to phrase out, a new generation come on in. So I'm still president of the corporation, but my son is manager of the farming operation. Our next generation is 3 daughters. Of course, one of those will go out and get a fellow interested in farming and move back in here again, I guess. So this is an old homestead. And we've tried to preserve it and keep it and maintain it and keep things remodeled and fixed up to keep it going. And we've so far managed to keep it as a family farm. But not many of us left. My son is 46 years old, and 46 years ago we put a milk tank in. Prior to that, everybody shipped the milk cans. And at that time, almost every farmer in Queen Anne's County had dairy cows. And they all were family farms. And then as time went on, the herds got bigger, and the younger generation weren't interested in dairy farming. They went on to do other things. People went to college as time went on. And when they went to college, they never come back to the dairy farm. They kept going elsewhere. Right now in Queen Anne's County, I think there's 21 dairy herders left. And at one time, I don't know how many farms in Queen Anne's County, but probably 1,700. And we're down to, I think, 21 herds right now.
Franklin Moore is a dairy farmer near Centerville, Maryland. His family has worked the farm for nearly a century. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.